If you will turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21, which is where I'd like to start today. In this book, Paul is writing a letter to this church in Ephesus, and he is giving them some instructions in the early part of chapter 5 from a congregational standpoint. He's exhorting them in some ways. He's giving them kind of some instructions about day-to-day stuff, about how they should act, how they should be one to another, as well as just some logistical work. And he comes down to verse 21 of Ephesians chapter 5, and he tells them to submit to one another in the fear of God. To submit one to another in the fear of God. Now, it's a bit of a, simple sentence. It's probably one we look over and gloss over when we're reading it in many ways, because it doesn't seem to be that in depth. It's not like this, hard scripture to really bound upon. But Paul felt the need to really describe what this means, because he's going to take the entire rest of chapter 5 and even into the first 9 scriptures of chapter 6 to really describe what this means to this group here. Because after he makes this statement to them to submit to one another in the fear of God in verse 21, verse 22 through verses 33, he's going to begin to talk about what it means to be husbands and wives and what it means to submit to one another in that standpoint. And then in the first part of chapter 6, he's going to talk about parents and children. And then he's going to get down into the second part there, and he's going to be talking about what he calls bond servants and masters, or what he's talking about are slaves and masters, or really then coming down to what in modern day we'd probably talk about with employers and employees, the relationship that exists there. Now, he felt the need to do this. We might gloss over some of this. We may read some of this maybe at a wedding is where we might hear, some of the parts talked about, husbands and wives, but we don't really look at this. But he felt the need to dive into this for a very specific reason. It was because at that day in the Roman society, the city of Ephesus was one of the largest cities in the Roman Empire at the time. It was a vast city that sat on in Asia Minor, right on the Mediterranean Sea. It was a big seaport. It was a large Roman city. And in Roman society and in the Roman times, these three relationships were not what we would think of today. They're not how we would characterize parents and children or relationships of husbands and wives. They were relationships that were bound primarily on the aspect of domination, the aspect of exploitation, of lording over one to another. Husbands had complete and utter control over wives. Parents complete and control over their sons and daughters. And obviously it was a society that lived on slavery and had control over other human beings. And so Paul, all these people are in this congregation, so Paul's writing to them and he needs to tell them that you need to submit one to another. But he has to go on to kind of define what that means, because all three of these relationships had been changed from what God had really laid out. I mean, marriage was created at the institution in the first part of Genesis, but it had been changed. It had been corrupted over all this time. And so Paul felt the need that he's going to go through and what it really means, wives to husbands to wives, parents to children, and define it, all under the semblance of that verse 21 where he's talking about as a congregation. Remember, he's talking to a group here. He's talking to the people, to the church, that you need to submit one to another in the fear of God, and here's what that really means, because it was a concept that they really didn't understand. And though we may view marriage and parenting differently now, and luckily it's very different than we'll get into what it really meant to them, we still can learn lessons from this in understanding what it means as a congregation and as people in God's church now to really submit one to another and what that really means and how that interacts with our relationships as people, but also how that interacts with our relationship with God as well, because all three of these institutions were given to us to help better understand our relationship with God the Father and with Christ our elder brother and future husband, if you will, as well. The parallels are all there. So all three of these relationships at the time were based on power, domination, and exploitation, but what he's changing them to these people, returning it, if you will, is probably the better word, is there should be relationships that are based on mutual concern and genuine submission. And those are the two words we're going to kind of carry as a theme throughout all three of these examples, because we're going to go through all three examples, these three relationships that exist. And what I want to come back to each time is how what they really should be based on is genuine submission and mutual concern, not power exploitation and domination is what they were to these people. So try to keep in mind, we're trying to think of this like a Roman congregation at the time and how they would have looked at this. Because what Paul is really doing when he shows up on the scene here telling them this is changing everything. I mean, this is, you know, we use the words paradigm shift or a game changer, you know, now, you know, phrase that he's, you know, about to blow their minds and what they would have thought and what he's telling them how they should have been. This would have been a drastic change from anything they would have really expected to hear or expected to be like. And we'll kind of go through that as we go. So that's what I would like to do in my time today is tackle these three relationships one at a time and see what we can learn from them and see what we can apply to our lives. So it starts, we read verse 21, verse 22 through verse 33 of Ephesians 5 then is going to detail out the relationship of a husband and a wife. It is the longest of all of the three relationships that we'll talk about here, I think for due course. So marriage at the time, in the time of the Roman Empire, would have been one where the husband had complete and utter control over the wife. And not just control, but basically control even unto death. He had the legal power and the legal ability to put his wife to death if he chose to for sometimes vague or nebulous reasons if he needed to. A wife could be caught in infidelity and a man could get away with it, could put her away. Or even put her to death without any legal ramifications whatsoever. On the flip side, the man could do whatever he wanted, and the female had no legal ramifications to do anything in the reverse side. It was a complete one-way street. A male had complete and utter control. It was a top-down, domineering approach that was applied, and there were no repercussions ever for the male. And the legal system supported this and allowed this and honestly even really encouraged it. So it was not one of necessarily that mutual respect that we're looking at here. This was the standard view that they would have had at the time. But then Christ begins to tie this aspect of marriage to the relationship of himself with the church. And that's really the heart of this message here as we begin to look at the relationship between a wife and a husband and a husband and a wife. And that this is really talking about us as a church, as a congregation, as the church of God as a whole is the coming wife for that will be married to Christ. And so understanding this is really important. And so as you begin to look through this, that's where our mentality should almost be. Because, you know, verse 22 starts out, wives, submit to your own husband as to the Lord. This would have been nothing new. They would have been sitting there going, that's right. Yeah, she should. Yeah, she should submit to me. I'm the husband. Yes. You know, that's how they would have been viewing this. But as it gets down and begins to go down a little bit more, you know, we get into a little bit of a change. Let's turn over to Colossians chapter 1 first before we really get into all these. Colossians chapter 1. I want to use to set the stage a little bit. Colossians 1 verse 18 says, "And he," talking about Christ, "is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, in all things that he may have preeminence." And this is coming after verse 15 earlier that says, "He," once again Christ, "is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over creation." So we recognize that our understanding of who Christ is and that this relationships that he's given us helps us to better understand him and helps us to better understand God the Father as well, as he was the personification of God that came down, and that they were given as for us to help better understand the situation, and that marriage is used here as a way to help better understand this relationship as well. So Colossians is kind of telling us that where though they help us to better understand through our relationship with Christ and our relationship with God what this really means for us with them as well. We are molded in his image. We are not to make some caricature of it. So when marriage had been changed over time for these people, you know, God set up marriage in Genesis in the beginning in creation, but over time it had been perverted and changed to, we get to this point here where Paul's coming on the scene with a Roman city, and they had changed it to everything it really should not have been. And to a point where you can't understand the relationship of our marriage to Christ if this is how you view marriage. And so it had become a caricature, but we are to be molded as God, so we're to change it back, and that's what Paul is doing, and we're to understand what it truly means. So back to Ephesians chapter 5, we'll get back to it. So we read verse 22 where it talks about the wives, but if we look down, a lot of it really talks then about the husbands. He spends more time talking to the husbands of what their role should be. Verse 31 kind of makes that same point I just made, though, where he references back to Genesis saying, "For this reason you shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." We're seeing here that the union was designed at creation to help teach us the way and teach us about this relationship, and it was given to us. But over time, unfortunately, it had been changed. Paul is not trying to paint the picture here of a husband who's domineering He's not trying to paint that as a ruling, you know, top-down exploitation approach, but he's going to paint the picture of a husband who's sacrificial. Verse 25 says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her." I mean, Christ really is the husband. And this is a husband who, though he had all power and he has the ability to demand, I guess if you wanted to say that exploitation and domineering approach, he loved the wife so much, the wife being the church, that he gave his life for her. And that's how he was able to show love, and that's how he was able to show submission. This is an attitude that creates an environment between the two that allows for that genuine response of love and respect to really come out. And that ties back to what I talked about, what we're talking about here, of mutual concern and genuine submission. You can have submission because you're afraid, which is what they would have had at the time. But in this case, he's talking about wives having submission because your husband loves you so much, he would lay himself down for you, and in this case, in Christ's case, to do away with your sins and to allow to pay that penalty for the sin of death. When that's what your husband does, then having genuine submission because of the concern that they show is given because you want to, not because you're afraid that he will put you to death for no apparent reason like they would have viewed marriage at the time. That's how genuine submission is born. He's speaking also to those who lead and that approach that has that, because this is all under the heading of submitting one to another, how they are within a congregation. Paul is defining the means by which we can interact with each other as well, not just as husbands and wives. And he's placing the responsibility of living up to these ideals on the individuals here, on the church itself. He's telling this congregation how they should act one to another. You know, we read verse 28 saying, "Husbands, love your own wives as your own bodies, as his wife loves himself." Verse 29 says, "For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church." You know, this is the mentality that we should have. And until we begin to start seeing the minds and bodies of others as if they were our own and start viewing that and putting that first to be cared for as we would ourselves, how we wish to be respected, until we begin to have that genuine and loving relationships, and if we don't have that of any kind, then we're going to continue to have problems that persist at the heart, if you will, that come from the heart, because if our mentality is not one that we place others first, that we place the needs of the congregation, the needs of the other people above our own, that Paul's talking about here that they should have, then our place will never be right, and we continue to have problems that are based on attitude, that are based on love or lack thereof in many cases, because that's what we're usually problems will persist from. We can't be teachers of love and respect unless our lives are first full of them. Because if we don't have it in ourselves, then others will notice as well, because it's our example that really teaches of who we are and what we believe, not our words. Paul is detailing out here exactly how these individuals should act one to another as members of a congregation and as a church, and exactly what it takes to love another individual, to love another person and to treat them as ourselves. And this isn't something on that superficial level, but he's talking about the true deep insight of gaining that mutual concern and genuine submission that he's looking at. Because Christ was able to have that, and that's what he's talking about. It's easy to submit one to another when that's the mentality you know that other individual has. And you, in turn, are able to provide that same mentality back and forth as well. Only then, and showing that mutual concern, can genuine submission, not the submission that these people would have had because they were afraid, because their life could be altered or their entire livelihood could be taken away. That's a whole different type of submission. He's talking about submission because you want to, because you know that the other person views yourself just as highly and esteems you just as highly. That's a hard thing to get. And you can imagine these people sitting here now in this congregation, they're talking about, this is how my husband should be. And maybe even the husbands are sitting there, you know, they're grown up their entire life with their view of marriage, how they think it should be. And now he's talking to them about how, you know, Christ had the complete power and he laid down his life for you. That's how you should be acting one to another, how this would have been a complete game changer for these people. You know, this would have been something that very foreign to them and an idea that they never would have been able to see before. And he has to spend this whole time, you know, this whole set of scripture here going through it. And he's going to do the same thing as he continues on, because we move on then to chapter 6. Verses 1 through 4 is going then to begin to talk about the relationship of parents and children. And this is a relationship that once again was marked by the same disparities of power that I talked about with that of husbands and wives, because once again in the Roman scene, a parent had complete and utter control over the child. Now, mainly it was the father had complete control, but once again, now the mother had an aspect of power as well over another individual. Children had no power unto themselves that was not first granted from their parents. There was a legal phrase that was present in the Roman world called patria potestas, which basically means lifelong subjugation of the child by the parents and bending to his father's will. You know, we in modern society, once you get 18, you can emancipate yourself and be done, and now I'm free to make my own decisions if I want. That didn't persist there. It didn't matter if you were 18 or 60. You were under your parents' control until you were married. Once you were married, then you did. The problem is, you could not legally get married without your parents' permission. And oftentimes, marriage was done from a political arrangement. It wasn't, hey, Dad, I really love this girl over here. I'd like to marry her. Well, that doesn't do anything for our family. No. But I'm going to have you marry this person over here you don't know, because that'll help bring our families together. The Roman society was very much bent on, you know, gaining some semblance of power or some, you know, there'd be some positive within the marriage. And so you were basically free from your parents once you got married, but even how you got to that point was completely and utterly under their control. Once again, the power was also even over life and death. The parents had life and death power over their children. Now, the Romans, I will give them, they were fairly progressive for their day. I will give them this one thing, because in most societies, including the Greeks, which was the precursor to the Romans, a parent could kill their child when it was born if there was a disability that they saw on the spot. The Romans, in their progressive sense, they were light years ahead. They were really good. They made you keep the child alive till the age of two. Then at the age of two, if you still felt that they were disabled, then you were legally allowed to kill your own child. So that was them trying to be the progressive society at the time, and what they granted the power. So they at least gave the child legal representation for 2 years, versus what had been the norm at the time, which is zero. So once again, this is how they viewed, you know, this is how children viewed submission. This is how parents viewed their control. So we're talking about, this isn't love, this is control over their children. It wasn't a relationship, if you will. And so now Paul's used this as the same example, talking about kind of changing what it really means, trying to teach these people what it really means to submit one to another. And he's using these relationships that to them were based on power and exploitation, and he's bringing them back around to that mutual concern and genuine submission. How he starts out chapter 1 of verse 6, so chapter 6 verses 1 through 4 are the four scriptures that talks about parents and children. He starts out verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Starts out just like he did over in verse 23 of Ephesians 5, speaking first to the one that was subjugated, if you will, if I could use that word. So in all three examples, he always starts talking about the one who already was having to submit legally, and he starts with them. But just like he did before, where he says, but he's going to come around to fathers, here's what you need to do. And he's going to do the same thing with parents here. I'm reminded in the way he words this, John chapter 8 has the story of the adulterous woman who's brought before Christ, and, you know, all the Pharisees are bringing her and they're accusing her. They're saying, you know, this is an adulterous woman, we need to put her to death, you know, stone her, she's evil. And, you know, Christ gets down and starts kind of playing in the dirt a little bit, and he looks up and says, you know, he who has no sin cast the first stone, and they're all kind of put in their place. You know, you think he's saving her, you know, he's on her side in this, he's taking sides, and so they leave. But before he lets her leave, the adulterous woman, he still looks at her and says, but you need to go sin no more. So he basically, on neither side, he's telling them both, you know, you're both wrong. So this is kind of the same, you know, Paul's using that same kind of literary sense here, where he always starts with the side that's subjugated, but he's going to come around to you as well. So, you know, he's sitting here, children submit, the parents are going, yeah, they should, my kid doesn't. I have two kids. I read this and I'm like, yes, I want to tell my son this every night. But he's going to come around, because we read on verse 2, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you, that you may live long on the earth. And then verse 4, and you fathers, I love this, like, I'm also talking to you, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. And he gives them an instruction, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. you're not to, you know, parents, you're not out of this as well. You're being jerks. You're not to just, you know, provoke your children to wrath and lord this over them. This is a relationship still. Now, a father and a mother do have, you know, an aspect of sovereignty over their child, but it's also a responsibility. He's telling them it's also your job to train them. It's your job to raise them up and to teach them the right things and the right ways to go. You're not completely absolved to do whatever you feel is right in your own eyes. You're to do what God is telling you to do. You know, there's, I think, a practical example of both of these points from the aspect of a parent and child trying to train genuine submission and mutual concern. We can find it back in Exodus chapter 18. Let's go back. Keep your place in Ephesians. We will be coming back as we continue on. But let's go to Exodus 18 and look at a practical example from the Old Testament. And we're going to look at the story of Jethro and Moses. Now, Jethro was Moses' father-in-law, but we don't really know a whole lot about Moses' father. And as we read through here, we're going to kind of see almost a father-son relationship that kind of exists here. So you can tell Moses respects Jethro, and Jethro does have like a fatherly sense over Moses. So though it's a father-in-law, son-in-law, indulge me if you will, I think the principle really is going to still apply. As this is just after they've come out of the Red Sea and all the great actions of the Passover season, if you will, the departing, the creation of this nation, and you know the miracles and the greatness. So this is the time where they've got to be riding a pretty big high. And then Jethro comes on the scene, not having been there for all of this, and comes for a visit in chapter 18. And I want to approach, we're going to read two sets of scriptures. The first one in chapter 18, verses 8 through 12, we're going to read as an example of genuine submission and what that really means and how one attains it in light of this parent-child relationship. Exodus 18, verse 8, and it starts and says, "And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them all on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. For in this very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them.' Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and offered sacrifices to offer to God." And it says then kind of goes on, Aaron came on. So in a scenario here where Moses could have been very easily, you know, bragged about all that he had done and, hey, I'm the leader of this group and look at all we did. Moses is correct in acknowledging that it was God that did everything. All of his words are as God brought us out. God offered this. So he recognizes, you know, Moses, even though he's the leader, he has a position here of authority, recognizes who really did it, who really provided all the things that happened. And Jethro, by the same token, is able to recognize God's premise and promise in all of this, and what he's able to do, coming down even that he knows that God is above all gods, and they offer sacrifices as thanks to him. That is how genuine submission is born. It's born first from acknowledging who really is in control. It's very easy to genuinely submit when you recognize that it is God who's really done everything. It is he who's been the provider. Both these people were in the right framework and the right frame of mind to recognize that neither one of them, you know, Moses, even though he's the leader, or Jethro, even as you know, wasn't on the scene, but is able to recognize that both of them recognized first and foremost who's responsible. And it was God that was able to do all that and provide that. And if that's your framework and that's the framework from which you start operating from, you begin to recognize really quickly that pride becomes a lot harder to creep in, and it becomes a lot harder to lord over other people and have that sovereignty of subjugation that we were reading about in Ephesians 5 and 6. Because if you recognize God's the most important one, that's what really starts. That's where genuine submission starts with, is knowing where our place is. Beginning to recognize that nobody is irreplaceable. You know, Moses is realizing he didn't do it. God could have called up anybody. And we know God can raise up stones if he wants. You know, I live in Indianapolis. I am a big football fan. I have learned this lesson painfully obvious over the past year because if Peyton Manning, who is my all-time favorite football player, I think the greatest quarterback of all time, can be a man who's made billions of dollars for the city and for the Indianapolis Colts, can be cut really quick, that quickly, then nobody I've realized is irreplaceable. That if Peyton Manning can be taken away that quickly for, you know, very fast, then anybody can. How could I think very highly of myself? No matter what we're able to attain in our lives, what levels in our jobs, in our careers, in our families, in our societies, we are able to attain, we can never get so high that God is not above us. And God can't easily just replace us with stones if he wanted to. No matter who we are, even a stone could play quarterback for the Annapolis Colts probably if God wanted him to. And hopefully that works out okay, because I really love my football. And I'm waiting for Sundays to get better with that. But that's really, you know, what it comes down to, because that's the mentality. If we start from that mentality, recognizing we're replaceable, no matter how good we do, then it becomes easy to begin submitting one to another, because we all recognize that no matter where we are, we're never going to be as high as we think we are. We are the children in the example that we're talking about in Ephesians chapter 1, or Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4. We're not the parents, we're the children. God is our Father. We start recognizing that we're all the children under him, just like we were all the wife in the first example, weren't we? We all were the wife that's going to one day be married in the marriage supper to Christ upon his return. And that's what the mentality we need to remember. We read through these verses in Ephesians 5 and 6 is we're always the lower one, you know, how they viewed that lower class. We're the children, we are the wife, you know, we're the ones who are not in the subject of power and sovereignty that they would have viewed it. Staying here in Exodus 18, so we saw there the idea of genuine submission. The idea of mutual concern, then, we can read in the continued story in chapter 18 here. Over in verse 19, then, so Jethro spends some time looking at how Moses is handling the day-to-day operations of the Israelite nation here, you know, that's in flux and traveling. And verse 19, after kind of seeing how Moses is sitting in court, he offers him some advice. This is kind of his parent moment. You know, I may not be your father, but I'm your father-in-law, and I can offer you some sage advice from my knowledge over the years. Verse 19 is him giving it. He says, listen now to my voice. This is Jethro talking. I will give you counsel, and God be with you. Stand before the people for the people, so that they may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which you must walk, and they must walk, and in the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them as rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter that they bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it'll be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. Moses was taking on, this was a massive nation that was traveling through the desert, and Moses was taking on the responsibility of all of them. Which is not fair to himself, because you're going to burn yourself out doing that, but it's also not fair to the people, because he was not training them and teaching them. Remember what we read back in Ephesians 6, verse 4, where he's talking about the parents. You need to train the child in the way up he should go. Jethro is telling him here, this isn't fair to you, but it's also not fair to the people. You need to train them. Train some over tens, some over fifties, some over hundreds, so that they can sit and rule. And now you've got people who know what's going on, that they can train others. And that's how you perpetuate the cycle within this nation. Instead of them being solely reliant upon you, but they can help do your work and save you some trouble, which is going to help you. But you're also going to be doing what God wants you to do, which is to train them, to edify them, to bring them up, so that then they may in turn go and bring somebody else up and train them and edify them. And that's how you spread throughout this congregation and bring them all, be greater than their sum of their parts, and raise up the whole. That's mutual concern. Jethro's telling him here is, you need to look out for them, and I'm going to look out for you. As that father, he's providing this wisdom, this sage-like advice, because he's concerned for Moses. He doesn't want him to get burned out and take all this upon himself. It would kill him. But he also is wanting to do it because it's the right thing to do, to train up the people. And in doing that, Moses is going to show that same concern for all the people, to train them and to teach them. And this perpetual growth within the community can take place, because you're constantly training and growing up everybody, and they can help everybody else out. The purpose of Jethro's counsel here is to both better serve the Lord as well as to better serve Moses. And that's how one shows mutual concern. We talk about that, how the framework that I view myself or view you above myself first, And I'm also looking out for you with the advice I give. You're much willing to submit it, submit to it, and accept it from them. If that's that framework, you know they're looking out for you, and they're offering you this to grow. They're offering you this to grow yourself and them and everybody as a whole. That's how that mutual concern is borne out. And that's what teaching, what Paul's talking about in chapter 6, verse 4, where he's telling the parents to raise the child and to train them correctly. Then they know that you really are looking out for them from a standpoint, and they're going to continue to grow. And then when they become parents, we'll do the same thing down to their children. Moses and Jethro are showing that a relationship between generations can be harmonious when both come together in genuine submission and mutual concern for each other. Because let's be honest, you know, communication between ages and groups can be tough. Dave and I were talking on the drive up today that I have an employee that I've unfortunately had to spend the past few weeks having some negative feedback, is maybe the best way to put it, with that I've had to give to them. And it's all based a lot, not on necessarily day-to-day performance, but it's on day-to-day attitude and how they interact. And it's the generational difference that I think is at part. And I'm only 33, and I'm already talking about younger people and generational differences, and that feels really weird, I got to be honest with you. But it's true, and we've all seen it, from no matter how young or how old we are looking at other ones. But this is how that is solved, and this is what he's kind of talking here, that these two generations are able to come together because of how they're able to submit one to another in the fear of God, like we read about in Ephesians 5:22. Paul's showing this relationship between generations and the roles and responsibilities present within them can be harmonious between the generations if need be. That the older generation is to train up the younger generation, and the younger is to honor the older and accept that advice, knowing it's coming from their goodwill and for them to grow. And that's the relationship that it should be, that Paul's really trying to bring back to these people here, and you know, that we're talking about, if we get back to Ephesians, then this is a group now that had lost this. You know, we're reading about it here in Exodus 18 of how it should be. Unfortunately, when Paul's on the scene in the first century AD, it wasn't that anymore. Just like they had lost what marriage should have been at creation and had completely perverted over time, they lost what this relationship between a father and a child, or a parent and a child, could be over the days. And so now, you know, children resent their parents and parents treat their children like property. And he's having to bring back these basic principles because they'd been so degraded that it was destroying them. And if those basic responsibilities within the family are broken down, how could a congregation grow? How could a congregation really be able to come together if they didn't even understand these basic principles? Because the church at Ephesus had a lot of problems. That's, you know, a whole other story. And so he's having to get them back to understanding these basic principles that we may sometimes overlook, but it's apparently important for this congregation to really be healthy, to be able to grow, and to really be able to overcome what they need to do. So let's go back then to Ephesians chapter 6. I told you to hold your place there. And in verse 5, we come to the third relationship that's present. That is the relationship of masters and slaves. Now, I will say in modern-day society, we're talking here about employers and employees, but at this time, slavery was very much apparent. In all reality, actually, there has been no empire in the history of mankind that has been so dependent on slavery to make it exist as did the Roman Empire. Throughout ages, it's been pretty well shown that slavery was the one and most important industry present that allowed the Roman Empire, the way it was structured at least, to grow and to prosper, and without it, it would have crumbled within a matter of days. This was a massive industry. At any point in time that we're talking about here in the first century, a third of the population in Rome would have been a slave. Now, it would have been a little bit differently than how we've unfortunately seen it in modern day, in that slaves at this time weren't just laborers. They were not there just as laborers. They were there doing almost everything. They were the teachers. They were the doctors. They were the librarians. They were the white-collar jobs that we think of in our society now. All this was slavery. If you were a wealthy family, your family physician, your children's teacher, your children's caregiver, your librarian, your everything that was done in and around you was done by a slave. And these slaves were basically people, as the Roman Empire, these massive legions of iron, as they went throughout the empire conquering, there would be whole caravans of slave traders that would just follow them. And so if I'm a centurion and I've just conquered a city coming in through Asia Minor and conquered a city, part of my spoils of war, how my wages are paid, is I'm allowed to take some slaves, and I just walk to the back of camp, and I sell these people I've taken who we've just conquered, and I sell them to the slave traders. That's how I make my money as a soldier. And those slave traders are constantly coming back and forth, taking them back throughout the empire. This was a massive undertaking in an industry that was all over the place. Now, they had a little bit more freedom. You know, there was a freedom religion with the slaves. How they were treated was a little bit differently than how we'd view it. Like I said, they were incorporated as part of the family, though they were still property. Because when Paul is talking here to this church, it is more than likely and almost certain that in this congregation that he's talking to, there are slaves sitting there and their masters are sitting right next to them. Or there's just masters and there's just slaves and the masters went with them, but they are allowed to go there for church. That this would have been a mixed congregation, you know, of all these people are present here. So when he starts talking to them, the slave at the time, this bondservant, can look right over next to them and maybe seeing their master and vice versa as well. So, and this is the scene he's talking about in verse 5 through verse 9 as he comes on and starts talking to him. Verse 5, he says, "Bondservants, be obedient." Once again, he always starts with the class that was kind of lower, like he did in the other two examples. "Be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart as unto Christ." You know, as a bit of an aside, I often think about if we look at the Old Testament, there's a lot of examples of men of God who were slaves. You know, this wouldn't have been a foreign concept in many ways. You know, Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, went and served as Potiphar's slave, and then eventually then moved up into the court in Egypt. Daniel was Nebuchadnezzar's slave. You know, Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian Empire comes through and conquers Jerusalem, sacks it, murders thousands of people, burns the city to the ground, and takes Daniel as a slave, recognizing his importance with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as well. All of them were taken as Israelite slaves back to the court of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel had to serve the man who was responsible for destroying his nation, for killing his family and friends, for destroying his city and burning it to the ground and enslaving his people. And now he had to go serve him as his bondservant, if you will. So there's lots of examples for them to kind of to go back upon. And here, Paul's saying, "Servants, be obedient to your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart." Verse 6, "Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with goodwill doing service as to the Lord and not to men." He's setting the criteria here for them. But this is also, you know, if we think in the modern day, how we as an employee should be as well. You know, we may take a paycheck from a company, but this is how we are to act as an employee for any company, be they a Christian organization or not, be they people of the church. This is how we are to be as well. Because this is how Daniel was. Daniel had to go serve that man who, I have a hard time thinking how you couldn't hate that person. You know, a phrase and something we really shouldn't be, but, you know, how evil Nebuchadnezzar was, and Daniel had to go serve him. But, you know, you read through that book of Daniel, there's nothing negative said about Daniel, and he doesn't do anything negative. He was and serves better than anybody else. He goes and does the job better than anyone else, which is why he raises in prominence. But he does exactly what Paul is talking about here. Joseph did the exact same thing. He was accused of doing something wrong in Potiphar's house, but he never did. He was a great, Potiphar recognized how good he was. That's, you know, what Paul's talking about here is you find yourself in this position, you do it with all your might. Because he's using words here in chapter 6, verses 5 through 8. He's talking words like obedience, goodwill, sincerity of heart. He's talking about attitude. He's talking about how we view ourselves, how we act. You know, Paul, that's what Paul is talking about, these people. You know, he says here in talking about, you know, about Christ as well. Christ, when he is brought before the Sanhedrin, had the power to call down angels. He's in a sham trial, if you will, that's getting ramrod through. He knows, you know, he's not getting a fair trial. He had the power over all of them. But he submitted to the authority of the time and went through it because it was the right thing to do and it was the purpose of it. But he didn't have to. I mean, if he wanted to, he didn't have to submit to that. He could have snapped his fingers and be done with it. But he did. And that's kind of the same mentality Paul's talking about here. We don't always say it's fair, but that's what genuine submission comes to here from the ruling authority that he's talking about. You know, just as Daniel was a slave and served in Jerusalem, genuine submission sometimes means to authority that is not just. And we live in a society, unfortunately, that is not always just. But what's really important here is how we do our job. If I'm an employee for an organization, I do my job correctly. I do it with a good attitude. I don't, you know, hey, I have the truth, so I don't have to do what you say. You're just a Gentile, if you will. You know, this entire church here were Gentiles. This is Ephesus. This isn't the Jewish congregations. These are people who had all been Gentiles who are coming into the faith. This is their attitude and how they were was of the utmost importance. And the same thing is true to us. The same thing was true to Daniel, to Joseph, and to Christ. How they acted and how they behaved, even in situations that were not great, was important. Paul's not trying to change the establishment here. He's not telling them to rise up and revolt and start a war. He's telling them to do your job because that's how that's what you do. We do the right thing because of who you are, just as Christ did, just as Daniel did, just as Joseph did. But remember, he always comes down to the other side too. So all the slave master may be sitting there, the master, but there always comes down then, and there's verse 9. And you masters, lowercase m, do the same things to them. He turns it back around really quick then. Giving up threatening, knowing that your own master, uppercase M, is also in heaven, and there is no partiality in him. So he turns it on its head. Remember, you bondservants, you got to have a good attitude and do what's right. But you masters have to do the exact same thing. And you know why? Because we all have a master who's up above. We get back to that same thing, no one's irreplaceable. Though you may seem you have power, once again, we're all that lower class. We're all that, the lowercase here, because there is a master up above who is over us. He's pointing out that there's always someone above you. No matter what we rise to, you can become president or emperor or dictator for life of the whatever country you like, there's always somebody above you. There's always somebody, in this case, there is always God above you. And he is our master, and he treats us better than we could ever earn, doesn't he? We have in no way earned the right to be treated as well as we do and be forgiven and earn what Christ did for us in offering up that sacrifice for us. So that's not how we want our master to be with us. And how should we then in turn deal with other people? Over in Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, he kind of makes some of the similar points, saying, this is another aspect of Paul, saying there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female, for you all are one in Christ. This entire congregation, like I said, there was probably some bondservants, some slaves, and some masters sitting there. Paul's making the point, you're all the same. Now, society at the time did not deem them that. But this is the point he's making, and this is as you come into a congregation and as a church of God, you all are the same. We're all under God as our master. A city that some say whose beauty may not have been rivaled even to this day. I mean, Babylon at the time was a magnificent place by physical standards, and he walks around as the ruler of this nation, the most powerful man who can do what he pleases. People bow before him as he walks around, and he gazes out upon it, and he starts to think how great he is. He begins to have that pride and imagine that it's all because of him. And in that moment, God teaches him a lesson as he strikes him down to live as an animal for the next 7 years, to walk on all four legs as nails grow out and he eats grass and acts and forages like a dog would. And just that quickly, in the blink of an eye, God can do that to what was at that time the most powerful man. And that's the lesson that you learn is there is that someone who's always above us. Mutual concern is founded in the fact that we are all under God and we're all in the same status as a Christian. I mentioned, you can kind of begin to think here of how these people would have viewed all three of these relationships in their sense before hearing all this, and how disparate it would have been to what God really wanted that to be. And what Paul is coming here and telling them and submitting one to another and what that really means, and how this would have been a complete paradigm shift for them and a brand new thing. But imagine if that's how those three views, I told you how the Romans viewed all three of those relationships, and then Paul's coming on and telling you this is how it should be. How excited would you be? How great would that be? You've never known anything different. This is the Roman Empire was everywhere at this time. It was well established. This is, roughly 50, 60 years after, the turn of the century. The Roman Empire had been established before Christ's time. They didn't know anything different. How excited would you be when Paul's coming out and saying that this is how it should be? This is what marriage really is. This is what parenting really is. This is what your relationship from an employer-employee really is. Thomas Cahill, who is a modern author who wrote a book called Mystery of the Middle Ages, makes this point, much like some other authors do, that this is one of the main reasons that the spread of Christianity was so profound, obviously with the help of the Holy Spirit and God granting it as well. But this relationship change that we're reading about here in chapter 5 and 6 of Ephesians is one of the main reasons the church was able to spread so quickly and bring in so many converts. He writes in his book, quote, "Christianity's claim that all were equal before God and all equally precious to him ran through this class-conscious, minority-despising, weakness-ridiculing Greco-Roman society like a charged current. It's no wonder, really, that the primitive church seemed almost fairyland harbor to women who had always been kept in the shadows, and to slaves who had never before been awarded a soupcon of social dignity or political importance." He used some words we don't really use in the modern vernacular anymore, but I think the point is still heavy. If you're a woman or a slave or even a child in this society, or you know, and this is what Christianity is telling you it should be, yeah, sign me up. You know, this is one of the main reasons. Edward Gibbon, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, would make the same point in his book, that as Christianity spread throughout this empire, this was one of the main tenets that attracted people at first glance. This, you know, granting power in relationships and reestablishing what marriage should be, reestablishing what the parental relationship should be from what had been perverted over the ages and been present at this time, that getting it back and all these people recognizing that they're all equal and that submission one to another becomes important is one of the main reasons this church was able to spread. This was what he is saying here in chapter 5, verses 22 through verse 9 of chapter 6, was a, you know, the equivalent to what Dr. King did in our modern society, what Mahatma Gandhi was able to do. This is someone coming on the scene with something and changing it, how the entire establishment viewed everything. This was a big shift in paradigm, how everybody in the church and society would have really viewed these three relationships. And so we might overlook them now and think, oh yeah, that all makes sense, I agree. To them, this was brand new. And it had to be, in many ways, very exciting. And it changed how they would have to be together as a people. Paul was changing the attitudes of this fledgling church, and he was using these relationships that would have been characterized typically by exploitation, by domineering, power-oriented relationships that were based on power, and he was using them to do it. He was using those to change these attitudes in this church. He was using these extremes to show how different Christ was, how different God the Father was, and how different he wanted us to be from the rest of the world, and how God the Father and Christ his Son were embodied all three of these relationships and our place within them, and using these three relationships to help us better understand our relationship with him as well. All of them were used to help demonstrate how we as individuals should be with each other as a church, on a local level, on a national level, on an international level. Because if we don't understand this, if we don't understand truly submitting one to another, then we're bound to, in perpetuity, continue to have the problems that we've had over the past couple decades. And that I'm speaking in the modern era. I think this becomes apparent and incumbent, because if we don't understand this, and we don't always do, then we're bound to continue to have problems that are based in attitude and disagreements and lack of genuine submission and lack of genuine mutual concern one for another. Paul is changing how these people viewed things, how their attitudes were to each other, to help them better understand our relationship with God and with Christ. And that's what these relationships really are for. That's why he gave us marriage. That's why he gave us the idea of parenting and relationships. That's why he gave us the ability to work with one another and as congregations, because to better understand our one-day relationship that we're going to have with him. So if there's one takeaway I would give you, it's that if we claim as individuals in the Church of God to be genuine believers, then our lives must reflect this truth, shouldn't it? We can't be teachers of love and respect unless we are first willing to put our lives full of them and full of mutual concern and genuine submission first in our own lives.